Hi everyone. Good evening from Israel, and good day for everybody else. I think some people have a July the 4th public holiday today. Not in Canada, I guess, but in the US. Somebody just wrote, asked me if I have a web page. So it's on the source sheets, but I will just share in the chat what my website is, www.alexisrael.org, and that is the best place that you can get all of my teachings, and you can sign up for my weekly Parsha things on my website. Fine, I'm going to ignore the chat till right the very end, and I'm going to launch into our topic for today, and that is we're going to be talking about the book by Rabbi Sacks called A Letter in the Scroll. And in England, it was called Radical Then, Radical Now. I have to say, if you are looking for a wonderful bar mitzvah present, if you are looking for a great bat mitzvah present, if you're looking for a present for somebody who is interested in Judaism, this is a fabulous book. Because this is really Rabbi Sacks's attempt to explain why be Jewish. That's really what he's aiming at in this book. And I'm going to share my screen. And let's just read through the opening paragraph of this book. He writes, today, this is Rabbi Sacks, today, throughout the diaspora, one Jew in two is either marrying out or not marrying. Or in some other way, deciding not to create a Jewish home, have Jewish children, and continue the Jewish story. At such moments, rare in our history, we or our children face the question, who am I and why should I remain a Jew? The question can never be answered in the abstract. It is an intensely personal and demands a personal reply. This is my personal reply. None of us can answer this question for anyone else, but it sometimes helps to know how other people have thought about it, which is why I have decided to publish this book as an open letter to the next generation. In other words, why, who am I, and why should I remain a Jew? This book, A Letter in the Scroll, is Rabbi Sacks's attempt to explain for himself why be Jewish? And in fact, we're going to end today's class with indeed a video, which is the conclusion of this book. It's in fact the last four pages of this book, and it is entitled "Why I Am a Jew." So we'll share that at the end of the class. In order to explain a little bit about this book, first of all, let me say that we've already met Rabbi Sacks quite a bit. But I'd like to say a few things about Rabbi Sacks and the story that he tells in this book, because he sort of tells the story about how he went to university in the 60s and he was really excited by a world of ideas. He'd grown up in a very Jewish home. He had grown up in a home where they went to synagogue regularly on a Shabbat. We'll read in a minute a story about his father. He wasn't a learned home, but it was a very, very Jewish home. His grandfather was a rabbi, but he went to university, and the way he talks about it himself is he suddenly found that he, here in the swinging 60s, he could really be anything. Suddenly you could really be whatever you want. You could swim in a world of ideas. And then the Six-Day War hit. The Six-Day War, he said, was really an incredible moment, because he said suddenly in the small little shul in Cambridge, Jews came out of the woodwork. People you didn't even know were Jewish, people who hadn't identified as a Jew, suddenly came to pray. People were really worried that Israel, which at the time was such a young country, 1967, Israel had existed for only 19 years. And now, as you probably many of you remember, or many of you know, the the sense was that Israel was really in peril in the weeks leading up to those few weeks leading up to the Six-Day War. And everybody was praying and hoping and rallying and coming together. And then there was the enormous victory. And it brought home to Rabbi Sacks, I'm not just a citizen of humanity. I am not only just a scholar of abstract ideas, philosophical ideas, which is a sort of like universal language of truth, but I am a Jew, and I can be nothing other than a Jew. And it was this deep dive that the Six-Day War gave him into Jewish identity, which led him on a journey of exploration, whereby the next summer, the summer of 1968, he actually went to the United States, and that was the summer that he went visiting a whole bunch of different rabbis. In fact, he had read a symposium in 1968 in Commentary magazine, a symposium where they asked something like 40 of the greatest Jewish thinkers alive at the time, and asked them a whole series of questions about the future of Judaism and the challenges of Judaism. And Rabbi Sacks said, you know what, I want to go to the United States and I want to look up some of these people and visit them. And that's what he did. And this was where he got the opportunity to meet two of the greatest rabbis of the time, Rabbi Soloveitchik and the Lubavitcher Rebbe, two of whom made the most unbelievable impression on his life and really affected his Jewish journey for the rest of his life. Let's take a look at the table of contents of this book in order to see what is happening there. Part one, the question, why be Jewish? And a few answers. Who am I? Who are we? And then, sorry, this should be on a new line, a letter in the scroll. That's where we're going to start in a couple of minutes. Then he talks about the journey. What does he mean by the journey? The journey that Judaism takes. What is the journey of Judaism? And he starts off, and we'll do this together, a palace in flames, the idea of man. That's going to be about Sefer Bereshit. Then covenantal morality. That's going to be about Sefer Shemot and the chosen people. Then he's going to talk about the vision, Exodus and Revelation, covenantal society, tragedy and triumph, which is really the story of exile and redemption, and the notion of truth lived, and then the future. In the Valley of the Shadow, of course, is emerging out of the Holocaust, ambivalence and assimilation. This is ours and why I am a Jew. That's the table of contents. It gives you a sense of how Rabbi Sacks is going to take us from the beginning of the Torah all the way through the present day, telling a grand story. Now, by the way, this is one of his most readable books. This isn't any, he doesn't quote so many philosophers. This is a book which, as I say, an intelligent teenager should read with ease. It's not a heavy philosophical book as some of his others. It's about 200 pages and it's a real easy read. And I've got to say, I've read this book maybe 10 times, and each time when I was reading it again in order to prepare this class, I said, just turned around to my wife and said, this is just so inspirational. Every Jew should really read this book. So let's try and enter into some of his ideas here. And I want to start off with, again, remember, this is a book about why be Jewish. Why should I, as a modern person, want to be Jewish? And I just want to share with you one of his images. Take a look. It's on page 2 of your source sheet, and you see it on the screen right now. Hold on, maybe I can make it a wee bit bigger. Does that work? Okay, this should work. It works on my screen. I hope it works on yours. We are in a vast library. In every direction we look, there are bookcases. Each has shelves stretching from the floor to the ceiling, and every shelf is full of books. We are surrounded by the recorded thoughts of many people, some great, some less so. And we can reach out and take any book we wish. All we have to do is choose. We begin to read. We can break off and try a different subject, a different approach. There is no limit. Once the book no longer interests us, we can put it back on the shelf, where it will wait for the next reader to pick it up. It makes no claim on us. It is just a book. That, for the contemporary secular culture of the West, is what identity is like. We are browsers in the library. There are many different ways of living, and none exercises any particular claim on us. As browsers, though, we remain intact, untouched. Judaism asks us to envisage an altogether different possibility. Imagine that while browsing in the library, you come across one book, unlike the rest, which catches your eye because on its spine is written the name of your family. In other words, you find a book and it says, for me, Mishpacha Israel, the Israel family. Intrigued, you open it and you see many pages written by different hands in many languages. You start reading it and gradually you begin to understand what it is. It's the story each generation of your ancestors has told for the sake of the next, so that everyone born into this family can learn where they came from, what happened to them, what they had lived for and why. As you turn the pages, you reach the last, which carries no entry but a heading. It bears your name. Were I to find myself holding such a book in my hands, my life would already have been changed. Seeing my name and the story of my forebears, I could not read it as if it were just one story amongst others. Instead, reading it would inevitably become for me a form of self-discovery. Once I knew that it existed, I couldn't put the book back on the shelf and forget it, because I would now know that I am part of a long line of people who traveled towards a certain destination and whose journey remains unfinished, dependent on me to take it further. I am a Jew because, knowing the story of my people, I hear their call to write the next chapter. I did not come from nowhere. I have a past. And if any past commands anyone, this past commands me. What a beautiful image. This image that we pick up a book, and this book is written by my ancestors who were slaves in Egypt, and who then came to the promised land and spoke ancient Hebrew, and then went Al Naharot Bavel by the rivers of Babylon, and then came back with Ezra and Nehemiah, and then went into exile, and maybe went to Babylon, and who knows where they went from there, right? They went to Yemen, maybe they went to North Africa, maybe they went to France and studied with Rashi, maybe they were exiled to Poland, then made their way to England, and now live in Israel. Wow. And now, what's Rabbi Sacks saying? I'm not just a person of the world. I can't be somebody who just sits in a library and says, if I fancy, I'll be a capitalist. And if I fancy, I'll be a communist. If I want to, I'll become this or I'll become that. There's a book with my name on it. Now, Rabbi Sacks here is drawing actually on some very deep Hasidic ideas or Kabbalistic ideas, because this name of the book, A Letter in the Scroll, in fact, comes from a teaching of the Baal Shem Tov. And the Baal Shem Tov, or maybe if I'm not mistaken, it's the Arizal, I can't remember, talks about the idea that, in fact, there are 600,000 letters in a Torah scroll. It's not fully accurate, but bear with me. There are 600,000 letters in a Torah scroll. And if you read the censuses, we just read the census of the book of Bamidbar, the book of Parashat Pinchas last week, and there we have 600,000 Jews. And therefore, every Jew is a letter. Now, we all know that a Torah scroll, which has one letter missing, is disqualified. It is pasul. One cannot use it. It is invalid in order to read the Torah. In other words, every Jew is necessary. Every Jew is needed. Every Jew represents a letter from the Torah. Every Jew has a story to tell. Every Jew bears a legacy. Every Jew goes back to the beginning of the Torah. And then I'll say something even deeper from a Kabbalistic level, which is that there is a Talmudic passage which says that even to create the world, God created the world through speech. God used Histakel Ba'oraita Ubara Alma. He looked at the Torah and created the world. In other words, the very infrastructure of the world, the very paradigm of the world is predicated on the letters of Torah, or in some way, the revelation of God through language. But I have a letter. I have a page in the book. Am I going to live up to it? Here, it is not me who has to find, what do I want to do? I have a calling. I have a calling which calls out to me from history. I have a calling which calls out to me from the very fabric of the ancestors that, that that predate me and the infrastructure of the world, which is saying, you have a role, you have a legacy. And that is the letter in the scroll. I am a letter in the scroll, and so are you. So this is the first, if you want, image that Rabbi Sacks gives to us when he's discussing the question of assimilation and people losing their Jewish identity, that we have to be aware that we are in this library and we're not just here to pick and choose. We are here to be somebody who has to write the next chapter, because if we don't write our page, if we lose the book, then this historic legacy, well, who knows what will happen to it. Of course, this has many, many segments, this book, and I'm going to try and summarize some of them, and this is what we do every single time. And if we had, I don't know if everybody's got this printed in front of them. And when I teach this in the classroom, as you can see, I've written by source number two, please read on your own. But since I don't know whether people can read on their own, because I don't know whether everybody's got it printed in front of them, I'm going to summarize some of the stories that Rabbi Sacks tells. So please excuse me if I'm going to be talking a bit too much. But I'm going to summarize some of the stories he tells and then get into some of the ideas. So I've brought you a whole segment here in source number two. As you can see, it goes through page two, page three, and into page four. Let me just tell a few of these stories. The first thing that Rabbi Sacks says is really remarkable. He brings the story of Yaakov fighting the angel. I'm sure it's one of the most iconic scenes in the Tanakh, so I assume people know it. And we always, who's Yaakov fighting with? Who's Jacob fighting with? He's fighting with a man in the night. And it's not clear who this man is. Rabbi Sacks says, who is this man? He says, it was Jacob himself. Yaakov was fighting with himself. It was an internal struggle. And what was his question? Yaakov had always wanted to be someone else. Who had he wanted to be? His older brother. He wanted to be Esav. Do you remember why Yaakov is called Yaakov? Yaakov is called Yaakov because b'yado ochezet ba'akev Esav. He was trying to hold on to Esav. He always wanted to be Esav. He dresses up as Esav. He wants Esav's blessing, right? Would he spend his life wishing as if he was someone else, or would he be content to be who he was? What's Rabbi Sacks getting at here? Rabbi Sacks is saying that Jews throughout history, what's our problem? We always want to be someone else. We want to assimilate. We want to be more British than the British and more American than the American, etc., etc. And he says, according to this reasoning, Jacob became Israel when he learned to be proud to be Yaakov, no longer holding on to Esau's heel. His blessing, his identity, his name, Yaakov conquered his sense of inadequacy and learned to be himself. And when he learned to be himself, when he could fight with his desire to be Esau and say, I don't want to be Esau, I want to be Yaakov. Now he can meet his brother and say, I'm Yaakov, you're Esau. I don't want to be Esav. I don't want to compete with you. I don't want to struggle with you because I know who I am and therefore I know who you are and we don't need to be in a fight anymore. What's he getting at here? And he says, let's just read this paragraph here. The scene has often replayed itself at critical junctions in Jewish history. Time and time again, Jews confronted nations larger than themselves, more powerful, more secure, more at home in the world. Ancient Egypt and Persia, Greece and Rome, Europe of the Enlightenment. And each time there were Jews who were not sure they wanted to be Jews. They assimilated or Hellenized or secularized. Each of these encounters was a collective crisis of Jewish identity, a paralyzing self-doubt. Jews didn't want to belong to the club that would have them as a member. They were Jacobs who didn't want to be Yaakov. And he says, I recall three scenes that made a difference to my own life. The first story, he says, is when he was a child and they were on holiday somewhere in the south of England and they had just gone to shul on a Shabbat. And in those days, right, he says, people didn't always wear their kippah in the street. And as he was leaving the shul, he was wearing his big kippah and a man came rushing up to him and his father and said to him, You've forgotten to take your yarmulke off, right? You didn't take your kippah off. And he was trying to be kind. And he said his father responded, got angry, and said, "No child of mine will ever be ashamed to be a Jew in public." And we continued on our way, says Rabbi Sacks. It was not a very tactful response, but it taught me, as perhaps no formal lesson could ever, not to be ashamed of who I was. Lesson number one. Don't be afraid to wear a kippah. Don't be ashamed of who you are. Lesson number two. Let's read it. The second event took place several years later. I was a student. I felt the pull of spirituality as never before. But I could I really embrace this life, which seems so narrow after the broad expanses of Western culture? Where in this world of Judaism was there a place for Mozart and Milton, Beethoven and Shakespeare? Where in this focus of existence was there room for the glittering achievements of the European mind? I wrote a note to the Lubavitcher Rebbe and told him of my conflict. I wanted to live more fully as a Jew, but at the same time, I was reluctant to give up my love of art and literature, music and poetry, most of which had been created by non-Jews and had nothing to do with Judaism. The Rebbe wrote back to me an answer in the form of a parable. He said, imagine two people who have spent their lives carrying stones, rocks. One carries rocks, the other one diamonds. Now imagine they're both asked to carry a consignment of emeralds. So the man who spent his life transporting rocks, emeralds are also rocks, a burden, a weight. After a lifetime, that's how he sees what he's asked to carry. But to the man who spent his life carrying diamonds, emeralds too are precious stones, different to be sure, but still things of value and beauty. So it is, he said, with different civilizations and faiths. To the person whose faith is just a burden, so too are other faiths. He does not value his own. How can he value someone else's? But to the person whose faith is precious, so too are others, because he cherishes his own. He values someone else's. His may be diamonds, the other emeralds, but he sees beauty in each. Said the Rebbe, in most cases, if not all, you will find your attachment to Judaism, that's the diamonds, will heighten your appreciation of the gifts of other cultures. In other words, the more deeply you value what is yours, the more you will value the achievements of others. I'll repeat that. The more deeply you value what is yours, the more you will value the achievements of others. This was a marvelous reply. More important, it was true as I discovered many times in the years past. I found that those who are most ease in their own faith have a capacity to recognize moral and spiritual greatness in whatever form it takes. The third moment took place when I finished university and was teaching philosophy. At the time, most of my other colleagues were Marxists. Some were Jewish, some were not. And he tells a lovely story about a very windy day in Cambridge where he was crossing the playing fields and his kippah blew off. And instead of putting it back on because it was so windy, he put it in his pocket and went to the lecture room. And the next day, he was summoned by the head of department, who was not religious at all. And he said to him, "Jonathan, is everything all right?" And he said, "What are you talking about?" And he says, "Well, yesterday I saw you crossing the playing field and you weren't wearing your skull cap." And I said, "What has happened to you?" It was an astonishing moment, says Rabbi Sacks. I suddenly realized that though he was not Jewish, he was deeply troubled by the thought I might be losing my faith, whether out of philosophical doubt or sheer isolation of being the only Jew on campus. I don't know if I now even fully understood his reaction, but I think it meant that my being true to my faith was part of the security of his world. Since then, I've encountered the phenomenon so many times in different ways that I'm tempted to assert in the form of two principles, which is not always true, more often than not. Non-Jews respect Jews who respect Judaism, and they're embarrassed by Jews who are embarrassed by Judaism. What is this section? As I said, Rabbi Sacks is trying to explain why be Jewish. His first argument is that you are a letter in a scroll. You are holding a book which was written by your forebears, and it carries your name, and it carries your story. So aren't you going to write the next chapter? But of course, there's a big world out there. And what he's trying to argue is never be ashamed to be a Jew. Number one, don't be ashamed to be a Jew. But second of all, other people are ashamed when you're ashamed of your Judaism. Other people are interested in you when you are proud of your Judaism. And holding your Judaism is like having diamonds, because once you have diamonds, you can appreciate rubies and emeralds. Because we value our culture, we will value other cultures. Our own tradition only enhances our respect for universal truths, for the truths of other traditions, for the truth of the world. It doesn't diminish it. It doesn't narrow us. So this is a second set of messages that Rabbi Sacks is giving to somebody who is wondering whether Judaism is the right way. And now I want to get to the middle section of the book. I read to you from the first section of the book, pretty much from the end of the book. And now we're going to take a look at the middle of the book, which is the mainstay of the book. And that is where Rabbi Sacks is going to argue that Judaism is radical then, radical now. As I told you, in America, this was published as a letter in the scroll, but in England, it was published as radical then, radical now. I don't know whether the word radical has a sort of negative tinge in American culture, and that's why he didn't want to use it. Obviously, he felt that in England, it has a very positive ring to it. Whichever way, Rabbi Sacks is going to claim, and we spoke about this a little bit in our first lecture, that Judaism is a radical religion, and that the way Judaism has brought truths into the world, Judaism has brought perspectives into the world which have changed Western civilization from the foundation. In fact, I'd say even more than that, which have actually underpinned Western civilization, and that we have so much to be proud of in our Judaism because we bear a legacy which is one which has been the crucible of the values that we hold dear. So let's try and share some of those ideas. Not all of them are on the sheet, but I'll start off with the way that Rabbi Sacks starts, which is, again, if you go back to page number one, you'll see that he begins this section, second section of the book. Here we go, The Journey. And chapter five in this book is called A Palace in Flames. What is the palace in flames? And here you will find yourself on page number four in the source sheet, page number four, A Palace in Flames. And this is a midrash that Rabbi Sacks loved to quote. A midrash about Avraham Avinu. Vayom, this is a passage from Bereshit Rabbah, one of the earlier midrashic books. This is a midrashic book written in Eretz Israel, midrashim, which were written probably in the third, written down in the third or fourth century of the Common Era, contemporaneous with the Yerushalmi. And out of all the Midrash Rabbah, Bereshit Rabbah is the earliest of all of them. Here we go. Let's begin with Vayom Hashem Avram Lech Lecha Me'artecha. I'm sure, as everybody knows, we don't really have a backstory about Abraham. The story about Abraham smashing the idols is not in the Torah. It's a medrash. It's a legend, but it's not written in the text. And there's very little backstory given to Abraham. We know where he comes from, Ur Kasdim. We know about his father, Terach, but it's not so clear why Abraham is chosen. We understand that later he becomes a sort of hero of sorts. But why indeed did God choose Abraham? What is so special about him? So here's an interesting midrash. Vayom Hashem Avram lech lecha me'artzecha. Rabbi Yitzchak patach. Rabbi Yitzchak opened and said, gave a pasuk from Tehillim. And Amar Rabbi Yitzchak mashal echad she'over mimakom la'akom v'ra'a bira achat doleket. There was a person traveling from place to place, and he saw a bira. A bira means a palace or a very large stately building. Doleket. Now I have to say there are different ways of reading this. Doleket could mean with the lights on. It could mean that the lights in the house are on, or it could mean that it's on fire. Rabbi Sacks reads it as it's in flames, it's ablaze. And he says, Tomar Shabira Zubalomanhig, there has to be somebody whose house it is. I mean, a house obviously has an owner. It's not like a field which could just be, stuff had grown. A house has an owner. Where's the owner? Tomar Shabira Zubalomanhig, Hitzitzala Bala Bira. The owner came out and said, Anihu Bala Bira. I am the master of the palace. That makes you wonder, why doesn't, if it's really on fire, why does the owner of the palace not put out the fire himself? Kach lefi shaya Avram Avinu omer tomar sha'olam hazeh b'lo manhig. Similarly, Avram Avinu said, could it be that this world has no owner, has no leader, has no guide? He tzis alav HaKadosh Baruch Hu and says, ani hu bal ha'olam, I am the master of the world. What is this midrash all about? Now, I have to say, there have been some who have seen this as read it in a much more mild way than Rabbi Sacks. For example, the way this was read by the Rambam was not that the palace is aflame, but the palace is all lit up. And what is this? This is the world of ideas. And Avram looks at the ideas of the world and the beauty of philosophy and says, you know, looks at the order in the world, the order in nature, and says, could it be that nature just came about like this, that everything is so wonderfully organized? And God says, I made it. Don't worship the sun and don't worship the moon. I've put the world into place. In which case, this is an orderly world. Hashem is in charge. And what's Avram being taught? He's being taught about how beautiful the world is, how wonderful the world is. That's the way the Rambam would read this. Some people think that the Bira, that the palace, is the palace of mysticism. It's the Sfirot, it's the upper world of truth. But let's take a look about how Rabbi Sacks is going to read it. For him, the palace is indeed the world, but the palace is on fire. It's ablaze. Let's read together here on page 4. With this, we arrive at the starting point of Jewish faith. Radical then, radical now, perhaps still not fully understood. Faith is born not in the answer, but in the question, not in harmony, but in dissonance. If God created the world, then he created man. Why then does he allow man to destroy his world? How are we to reconcile the order of nature with the disorder of society? Can God have made the world only to abandon it? In other words, the palace is on fire. We see so much suffering in the world, certainly in their world and even in our world, people abusing other people, people taking advantage of others. From time immemorial to the present, there have always been two ways of seeing the world. The first says there is no God. There are contending forces, chance and necessity, the chance that the palace produces variation, the necessity that gives the strong victory over the weak. There is no palace. There are only flames. The second view insists that there is a God. All that exists because he made it. All that happens transpired because he willed it. Therefore, all injustice is an illusion. Hakol l'tova. Everything is for the good, right? Somebody will say, don't worry, God has a plan. Even when bad things happen, God has a plan. It's all from God. Evil is the cloak that masks the good. In other words, you think it's evil, but eventually hakol l'tova. There is a question, but there's always an answer. There's a palace and there are no flames, right? So he says there are two philosophies. One says there are flames, there's disorder in the world, survival of the fittest. It's a dog-eat-dog world, right? You really think God's in charge, right? The natural disasters, the weather's crazy, human beings are cruel, only the strongest survive. That's opinion number one. There's no palace, only flames. Source, opinion number two. No, the palace is there. The flames are an illusion. But here's Rabbi Sacks. God created nature symbolized by the palace, but God seeking relationship created one being capable of self-consciousness and therefore freedom, and thus the ability to choose evil. And who is that? Man. Man having this ability uses it. Who set fire to the palace? Man. He sets fire to the palace, setting the world aflame. God can, but may not put out the fire. For if he does so, man is no longer free. Only man can put out the fire. Okay, so very simply, it's like this. God created a world. Bereshit, God created a world. And man, we know from the Garden of Eden, has free choice. Man can choose to not listen to God. and God's not going to intervene very much. Man can choose to murder his brother. And maybe when things get very bad, like in the flood, God will intervene, but that's only at the end. And therefore, man can set the world ablaze. Only man can put out the fire, but man is not alone. For God, the author of self-consciousness, is also the author of language. God not only creates, he communicates. God speaks to man and tells him how to extinguish the flames. Morality is not factual, how things are, or subjective, but covenantal, meaning God gives his word to man and man gives his word to God. God teaches, man acts, and together they begin the task of tikkun olam, repairing or mending the world. They become, in the rabbinic phrase, partners, shutaf b'maaseh breishit, partners in the work of creation. 4,000 years later, this is still a revolutionary idea and still an unfinished task. And let's get to this last paragraph and then. The faith of Judaism, beginning with Abraham, reaching its most detailed expression in the covenant of Sinai, envisioned by the prophets and articulated by the sages, is that by acting in response to the call of God collectively, we can change the world. The flames of injustice, violence, and oppression are not inevitable. The victory of the strong over the weak, the many over the few, the manipulative over those who act with integrity, even though they have happened at most times, in most places, are not written into the structure of the universe. The palace is aflame, and we are called on by God to take an active role. And now, what Rabbi Sacks does is he goes through the whole of the Sefer Bereshit and explains this idea. And let me just share a few ideas, although we're going to visit them in a later class. Rabbi Sacks suggests, and here, you know, I'll stop sharing because we don't need it. Rabbi Sacks suggests that Bereshit is in fact a revolutionary document. What do I mean? He says, think about when Judaism was born, when the Torah was communicated. The world was pagan. We were between two world cultures, Egypt and Mesopotamia, which were both pagan cultures who were believed in gods. Now, what's the world of the gods? The world of the gods is a world of power. What do I mean by that? If you read any of the mythologies of Egypt or the mythologies of Mesopotamia, and by the way, he says that Egypt has the pyramids and Mesopotamia had the ziggurats, right? So what are they? What are they both like sort of triangular structures? Why? Because you have the gods, which are all the forces of nature. And the gods are all powerful. They hold all the power. And what are human beings? There's only one human being, by the way, who is in God's image. Who's the human being in God's image? The king. The king is sent there by the gods to establish order in the world. And what are all the people there? They're to serve the gods. They're like the ants. They don't matter. Human beings don't matter. And even more than that, gods don't really have choices. Gods fight. In the world of paganism, I would say the gods are in the image of man. Gods fight with each other, they compete, they backstab each other. Gods have sex and have children, make mistakes, kill each other. And in fact, what's the idea? That whoever's strongest wins, and you better be careful because the gods are much stronger than you. And then we have this pyramid structure, right, whereby everything goes to the top. Who's the top of the pantheon? And everything else serves the top of the pantheon. And in humankind, who's the top of the pantheon? The king. And therefore, you serve the king and you don't matter. Now let's start with Bereshit. Bereshit. First of all, let's go back to Rabbi Sacks. How's the world created? Through language. Language for Rabbi Sacks is a very, very critical thing. And maybe I'll share with you next time a very important lecture where he talks about the power of language. But through language, God creates a world. The world is here because God wants it to be here. And God creates man in the image of God. That means what? That not only the king is in the image of God, everyone, every human being is in the image of God. Every, what do we say in the Bill of Rights of Man, all men are created equal, right? They really mean all humans are created equal, but in those times they didn't have women, as somebody once said. All humans are created equal, right? And more than that, all humans have free choice and we can choose what we want to do. I'd say more than that. Vayomer Elohim, right? God creates with words. And Vayar Elohim kol ha'asher asah v'hineh tov me'od. In the world of paganism, the world is a bad place, a scary place. In the world of Judaism, in the world of the Torah, we are here and it's a good place. There is hope. Human beings are given the ultimate responsibility, and every human being has responsibility to make choices which can make the world better. Just like God is a creator, we're in God's image. We have to create. We have to take responsibility for our world. That fundamentally underpins a completely different world. You know what? I'm going to take this one stage further. That's chapter one of Bereshit. But in chapter two of Bereshit, we find that man meets woman. And man, when he meets woman, you know what he does? Says Rabbi Sacks. Before he even pronounces his own name, he makes a covenant with woman. And it says, he says to woman, Etse me'atzamai, ubasar mipsari, you are the bone of my bones. You are the flesh of my flesh. Lezot tikare isha, ki me'ishu kachazot. You're called an isha because you were taken from an ish. Now says Rabbi Sacks, what's fascinating about this? You know what's fascinating? Until now, man has been called Ha'adam. We've never heard the name Ish. In order to create a relationship, you have to recognize the other person before you recognize yourself. We all have to recognize the other in order to recognize ourselves. And now Rabbi Sacks says something remarkable. He says, look at Sefer Bereshit. Whenever any of our ancestors come into contact with cultures who are not our family, they are always sexually compromised. What do I mean? Abraham goes with Sarah to Egypt. What do they do? Sarah is a very beautiful woman. They take her away. They want to take her for the Pharaoh. The same thing happens with Avimelech, with the Philistines. The same thing happens with Isaac and his wife, Rebekah. Think about it. Two strangers come to Sodom. And what do they want to do? You're strangers, you're vulnerable, so we'll rape you. Give you another story. You remember the story about Dina. Dina is a girl, an unknown stranger, goes into a town, Shechem. What happens? The man who is powerful takes advantage of her sexually. Joseph is a vulnerable slave. The mistress of the house, Potiphar's wife, tries to take advantage of him sexually. He says, within other cultures, within the pagan cultures, it's a power structure. And when I have power, I can use that power to dominate both in terms of putting you into a Beit Avadim, like we become slaves in Egypt, or dominate other people who are more vulnerable, dominate them even sexually. Now let's go to, as he says, the Torah's way of trying to do things, whereby the idea is that you have a covenant. And the idea of the covenant, he says, even the covenant of Sinai, God, what does God do before he makes the covenant of Sinai? He talks to us and says, do you want the covenant? And we have to say, Na'aseh v'nishma, we'll do it. And the covenant is enacted through words, through dialogue, through acceptance. I don't know what would have happened if we would have said no. But at least in terms of the narrative, right? First of all, he says, God is the God who is not God of the leaders. He's the God of the slaves. He's the God of the underdog. Hashem values every human being and says, you will not dominate other human beings. And when he makes a covenant, first, what does he do? He asks, are you willing to accept it before he imposes his law? God does not impose his law. God makes a covenant, which means that we both agree that this is the way that we are going to run our collective lives. What's he saying? That the fundamental ideas of the freedom of human beings, of the dignity of human beings, of the freedom of society, of the social contract, of the respect of relationships, is writ large into the Torah. And the Torah is radical then, and it's radical till today, because it gives a completely different paradigm to how we're meant to see our world. It is not a power paradigm. It is a paradigm of dialogue, of listening, of talking, of agreement, of freedom, of respect, of dignity, of choice, and most, maybe more, even more important, of action, because Avram has to put out the flames. God says, I'm in charge. I'll teach you how to do it, but you've got to put out the flames. You're going to have to argue for Sodom. You're going to have to practice chesed. In a word of power, you don't provide for other cultures. When strangers come to your tent in Sodom, you dominate them. What's Avram do? Avram sees strangers and he provides for them. He helps them. He assists them. He looks after them. He feeds them. That is the Jewish way. So this is the way that Rabbi Sacks is going to be saying that Judaism has an incredible message to the world, and Judaism changed civilization. That book in the library, right, which was written by HaKadosh Baruch Hu, which was written by your ancestors. Do you know what this, how special this book is? We, our culture, transformed the Western world, and the ethics of the West are as a result of this great gift that is our gift to civilization. Wow. Wouldn't you want to take this further? And he goes through all sorts of other messages as well in the book, but I'd like to just go to a couple of last ones because I can see our time is indeed marching on. I'm going to share the screen again. And we'll just go to one last idea. And then we'll watch the video and then we'll have some questions. One last idea here, the radical ideas behind simple actions. What does Rabbi Sacks say here? Walk into a shop, hand over a coin and buy a newspaper. No transaction could be simpler. You do it without even thinking about it. Yet in this one event, you're living on the surface of a series of institutions that, if fully excavated, would tell half the story of mankind. What does he mean? Let's see. The coin tells of the long evolution of man from hunter-gatherer to city dweller, where specialization and the division of labor led to the necessity of exchange, and thus a medium of exchange, and so eventually money, first as something valuable in itself, precious metal, and then as an abstract token. So he says, take a coin, right? And you will understand, if you understand what a coin is, right? That we were once hunter-gatherers, but then we became city dwellers, where we had to each evolve in different things. So we had to barter, we had to have a barter economy. And when it was too difficult to do that, we used money. First, it was gold and silver and bronze, but then it changed to a currency. And of course, different currencies and suddenly the economy. The newspaper, he says, speaks of a series of technological advances from writing to printing to the most modern forms of instantaneous global communication. It's also part of a political history that gave us the idea that in free society, we're entitled to open access to information. And then he says this, to be a Jew is on the face of it to be involved in simple things, right? So this is where he talks about the idea that, and this is his chapter, Truth Lived, right? The idea that what we do, for example, when we make Kiddush on Shabbat, right? When we make Kiddush on Shabbat, we are testifying to the need of human beings to rest, to the idea that even slaves should become free for one day of the week, that every human being is essentially free, the idea of a creator, right? When we live tradition and we eat matzah, we're returning to Egypt and we are re-experiencing our history, right? Every single action that we do, in other words, what's he trying to say? He's saying that you might think that Judaism has Tariag mitzvot, it has 630 mitzvot, but each of these mitzvot are a bunch of different actions and meaningless actions. But what Rabbi Sacks says, in the same way as taking money and buying a newspaper, you can, as he calls it, excavate any of those actions, and it tells you the story of mankind. he says, behind the entire tradition of Judaism, there are these whopping huge ideas which have affected civilization, and we remind ourselves and we enact them, we do them the whole time. And therefore, wouldn't you want to be part of this tradition whereby we sort of build these ideas into the way that we live, and we live these ideas out? So this is where he's going. What I've tried to do is give you a sense of the various different segments of the book, where on the one hand, Rabbi Sacks is talking about Jewish pride. On the other hand, he's talking about a Jewish legacy. On the other hand, he's talking about the contribution of Judaism or the Jewish narrative through the Torah and what have you to the entire civilization. And then he's also talking about, as you see here, the radical ideas behind simple actions. So I'm going to we're going to have some time for questions at the end, but what I would like to do to finish off, right, is to share with you the conclusion of the book. And the conclusion of the book is Rabbi Sacks's essay about why I am a Jew. And it's a sort of summary of many of the themes that he says in the book. And pretty much the last three pages of the book are in this animated video. So I'm going to stop my share. And I'm going to, hold on, let me make sure this is, Yeah, I hope this will work. 1 minute.
Be sure to share computer sound.
Yeah, I'm doing that. No problem.
Why I am a Jew. The deepest question any of us can ask is, who am I? To answer it, we have to go deeper than, where do I live? Or what do I do? The most fateful moment in my life came when I asked myself that question and knew the answer had to be, I am a Jew. This is why. I'm a Jew not because I believe that Judaism contains all there is of the human story. I admire other traditions and their contributions to the world. Nor am I a Jew because of anti-Semitism or anti-Zionism. What happens to me does not define who I am. Ours is a people of faith, not fate. Creative, generous, or successful. It's not Jews who are different, but Judaism. It's not so much what we are, but what we're called on to be. I'm a Jew because, being a child of my people, I have heard the call to add my chapter to its unfinished story. I'm a stage on its journey, a connecting link between the generations. The dreams and hopes of my ancestors live on in me, and I am the guardian of their trust, now and for the future. I'm a Jew because our ancestors were the first to see that the world is driven by a moral purpose, that reality isn't a ceaseless war of the elements to be worshipped as gods, nor history a battle in which might is right and power is to be appeased. The Judaic tradition shaped the moral civilization of the West, teaching for the first time that human life is sacred, that the individual may never be sacrificed for the mass, and that rich and poor, great and small, are all equal before God. I'm a Jew because I am the moral heir of those who stood at the foot of Mount Sinai and pledged themselves to live by these truths for all time. I'm the descendant of countless generations of ancestors who, though sorely tested and bitterly tried, remained faithful to that covenant when they might so easily have defected. I'm a Jew because of Shabbat, the world's greatest religious institution, a time in which there's no manipulation of nature or our fellow human beings, in which we come together in freedom and equality to create every week an anticipation of the Messianic age. I'm a Jew because our nation, though at times it suffered the deepest poverty, never gave up on its commitment to helping the poor or rescuing Jews from other lands or fighting for justice for the oppressed, and did so without self-congratulation, because it was a mitzvah, because a Jew could do no less. I'm a Jew because I cherish the Torah, knowing that God is to be found not just in natural forces, but in moral meanings, in words, texts, teachings, and commands, and because Jews, though they lacked all else, never ceased to value education as a sacred task, endowing the individual with dignity and depth. I'm a Jew because of our people's passionate faith in freedom, holding that each of us is a moral agent, and that in this lies our unique dignity as human beings. And because Judaism never left its ideals at the level of lofty aspirations, but instead translated them into deeds which we call mitzvot, and a way which we call the halakha, and thus brought heaven down to earth. I am proud, simply, to be a Jew. I'm proud to be part of a people who, though scarred and traumatized, never lost their humor or their faith, their ability to laugh at present troubles and still believe in ultimate redemption, who saw human history as a journey and never stopped traveling and searching. I'm proud to be part of an age in which my people, ravaged by the worst crime ever to be committed against a people, responded by reviving a land, recovering their sovereignty, rescuing threatened Jews throughout the world, rebuilding Jerusalem, and proving themselves courageous in the pursuit of peace, no less than in defending themselves in war. I'm proud that our ancestors refused to be satisfied with premature consolations, and in answer to the question, has the Messiah come? Always answered, not yet. I'm proud to belong to the people Israel, whose name means one who wrestles with God and with man and prevails. For though we have loved humanity, we have never stopped wrestling with it, challenging the idols of every age. And though we have loved God with an everlasting love, we've never stopped wrestling with Him, nor He with us. I admire other civilizations and traditions, and believe each has brought something special into the world. Aval zeh shelanu. But this is ours. This is my people, my heritage, my faith. In our uniqueness lies our universality. Through being what we alone are, we give to humanity what only we can give. This then is our story, our gift to the next generation. I received it from my parents and they from theirs, across great expanses of space and time. There's nothing quite like it. It changed and still challenges the moral imagination of humankind. I want to say to Jews around the world, take it, cherish it. Learn to carry it, and it will carry you, and may you, in turn, pass it on to future generations.
Okay, sorry about that. Obviously, I had a bit of a problem with the sound there, but I think we got the basic video. And what you can see here is that one of the things he does talk a lot about in this book is the power of Shabbat. The gift that Shabbat is, the way that Shabbat works as an antidote to society. So our hour is up here, maybe it's some time for some questions, but what I've tried to do here is really represent to you or communicate to you some of the, thank you, Nigel. I can see Nigel said, if you want to watch the video and catch the end, it's actually, the link is on the source sheet, so you can check it out on your own time. And what I've tried to do, as with every time, is to represent the book. Again, as I say, if you've got children or grandchildren or you yourself, it's really worthwhile reading because it's an easy read. And I think it really does raise a lot of questions and raise a lot of understanding about really why Judaism is indeed radical then and radical now. And this is Rabbi Sacks' statement when in a pluralistic world where one might say, why be Jewish? There are so many other identities. He's saying that really we have a treasure. We have an absolute treasure that God gave us and that is our heritage. And why wouldn't we want to embrace it? And why wouldn't we want to, you know, live that out in our very lifestyle? Because this is the gift that we were given. And it's the gift that we can give the world. So that's it. I wonder if we can post the link again. Maybe somebody can post the link again in the... Hold on, let me see if I can post it. If there are any... Hold on, I'll just post the... Here is the source sheet once again. Ah, thank you, Ollie. If maybe somebody wants to, I don't see too many questions in the chat. So if anybody would like to ask a question, feel free to mute yourself.
Has this book been translated?
Has this been books what?
Translated.
to other languages?
I know it's been translated into Hebrew. It's been translated into Ivrit, that's for sure. I don't know how many other languages it has been translated into. No idea. I know it's in English and I know it's in Ivrit.
What's the title in Hebrew? Do you know?
Radikali Az, Radikali Akshav. So not very creative translation. It's interesting because a lot of the contemporary works of Rabbi Sacks are translated by a guy called Sor Ehrlich, who's a very elegant translator. And this was translated by a different guy. And I don't love the translation into Ivrit, but it's okay. It's adequate. It's not fabulous translation into Ivrit. The more recent translations of Rabbi Sacks into Hebrew, I think, are a lot better. But Sor Ehrlich is really a gifted translator. Okay, so I will bid you all a good week.